Today's broadcast was originally recorded on March 11th, 2026.
This is a short-term disruption for the long-term gain.
Short-term pain for the long-term gain.
Short-term pain be for long-term gain.
We're going to have some short-term pain with long-term gain.
Short-term pay for a long-term gain.
Some short-term pain, yes, but we've got some long-term gain. Short-term spike for a long-term gain.
Some short-term pain for American consumers.
We may have to deal with that in the short term.
Short-term and temporary.
Temporary short-term pain.
It's going to suck in the short term.
Some short-term pain.
Short-term pain.
We have to focus on the short term.
Short-term.
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 Short-term and long-term.
Short-term. Blip.
Hopefully this is a short-term pain.
Short-term is highly outweighed of the long-term benefit.
Some short-term pain for the long-term gain.
Short-term sacrifice for a long-term gain.
You know, I'm no expert, but it seems to me like the White House and right-wing media may be coordinating their messages.
Well,
here.
I don't know why I came here tonight.
Just guess.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We will be joined shortly by our old friend David Ferris of Roosevelt University in Chicago on the ongoing, arguably worsening disaster of Donald Trump's war on Iran. You might have heard about that. The cost of it to the entire world right now, its threat to the global economy, not to mention global stability, as dozens of nations agreed on Wednesday to now release millions of gallons of gas from their national strategic petroleum reserves in order to try and ease price pressure on oil around the globe, as Iran has in response to the U.S. and Israel attacks, pretty much shut down all oil production at this point coming out of the Middle East. Is that fair to say?
Very fair to say. Completely predictable, as we've been reporting.
Completely predictable with their blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which apparently the super geniuses of the Trump administration completely failed to predict for some odd reason. Anyway, all of that fine mess shortly with the good professor. But on Tuesday, it was a midterm primary election night in Mississippi, along with some special elections elsewhere, which, frankly, in this case this week, as far as I can tell, proved to be a little bit more interesting than most of the, for now, fairly predictable results in Mississippi. For those special elections, let me begin in my favorite election state of, yes, Georgia, where where it looks like a Democrat won the special election contest for Marjorie Taylor Greene's old seat on Tuesday, but not really. Democrat Sean Harris did come out on top in the jungle-style primary election in Georgia's very Republican 14th Congressional District on Tuesday, where the two top vote-getters from any party will advance to the runoff election if nobody were to win 50% plus one of the vote. And with 14 candidates running for those two slots on Tuesday in Georgia, with Democrat Sean Harris having a very impressive showing, winning just over 37% of the vote. He was followed by Republican Clayton Fuller, reportedly with just under 35%. But unlike the Democrat Harris, the Republican in the race, Fuller, Clayton Fuller, had a competitive contest of sorts against fellow Republican Colton Moore, Moore ultimately won just over 11% of the vote on Tuesday. So both Moore and Fuller, who are both very MAGA, both of these Republicans, they had slugged it out for Donald Trump's endorsement. That finally went to Fuller in the end, even though Moore may be more MAGA than Fuller. But, you know, Trump isn't actually picking candidates he likes. He's actually picking candidates that he thinks are able to win, so he won't look bad. So with the endorsement going to Fuller, that means Moore was in second place among the Republicans, but Fuller took second place overall right behind the Democrat. And now Fuller and Harris are set to go on to the runoff on April 7th. Got any of that?
Mostly.
It was, in fact, a very impressive showing for the Democrat in a district that previously went to Donald Trump in 2024 by 37 points. So overall, I added up all of the Republican candidates who were running, all the Democrats who were running. Overall, Republican candidates took just under 60% of the vote on Tuesday. Democratic candidates won about 40% of the vote, again, in this very red district. It elected and reelected Marjorie Taylor Greene several times.
So that gives you an idea.
Kind of, yeah. But compared to Trump's win there in 2024 to Tuesday night's primary, that's about a 17-point swing toward the Democrat toward the Democrats overall in deep red Georgia. Yet another reminder to Republicans out there that if they didn't win last time by about, 15 points or more, then they are not necessarily safe this November, as the average in special elections since Trump's return to office has been about a 13-point swing towards Democrats. It was higher than that on Tuesday night toward the Democrat in the ruby red Georgia district of Marjorie Taylor Greene. And by the way, the precincts with the highest Latino voters, they went by enormous numbers. They swung towards the Democrat by 40, 50, 60, 70 points as compared to how they voted in those same precincts back in the presidential election in 2024. Let that be another warning to Republicans at this point. In the Georgia race, as noted, Trump endorsed Fuller, a district attorney, in the wake of Marjorie Taylor Greene's resignation in early January after she sort of fell out. One of Trump's top MAGA supporters previously sort of fell out with him over things like the Epstein files. Fuller's Democratic challenger, Sean Harris, is a cattle farmer, a retired brigadier general. And though he faces an uphill battle, it is against a party really at war with itself at this time in the Republicans. It would be a long shot, but Democrats are very happy with the outcome on Tuesday night. The fact that Republicans will need to spend some money to make sure they avoid really big embarrassment of yet another Democratic special election win in April, in just a few weeks' time. And yes, there will be a lot of elections between now and November in Georgia specifically this year and in this district. Tuesday's special election primary and next month's runoff. That's only to fill Marjorie Taylor Greene's seat for the remainder of this year. It is the first round of voting in what AP describes as an elections marathon in the Georgia district this year. Republicans and Democrats seeking a full two-year term, they're set for a May 19 primary. So we had the election on Tuesday in March. We got the runoff in April. Right after that, it's the statewide party primary. The entire state will hold their primaries, followed by the possibility of a June 16 party runoff before advancing to the general election in November. Last week, 10 Republicans and the Democrat Harris in the Marjorie Taylor Greene district, they all qualified to run in November for a full two-year term. That also includes Republican winner on Tuesday, Fuller, and the Republican Colton Moore. They're all going to run again, basically.
Wow.
And Moore, by the way, is a favorite of far-right activists. He finished in third place on Tuesday, short of the runoff, but a lot of MAGA folks preferred him over Donald Trump's choice. And so that's Georgia on Tuesday. The other interesting special election on the same night comes from the charming small towns of New Hampshire for a state house seat in a district that Donald Trump won. Again, this is the Carroll County District number 7. Donald Trump won that back in 2024 by a 9-point margin. Well, it is that district, as Bilbo Teach over at Daily Coast described it in his write-up, a quote, very ancestrally Republican district. Ancestrally. With only one town in the entire district voting for a Democratic candidate for president in the past century.
Wow.
That is, at least it was ancestrally Republican until Tuesday. Democrats flipped this Trump plus 9 district seat in the New Hampshire House, according to reporter Kevin Landrigan, who described the win as, quote, stunning and a, quote, major upset in the New Hampshire House special election, citing a huge turnout, nearly 39% of registered voters. I know that doesn't seem like much, but 39% for a special election in a tiny district in the middle of March, that's considered huge by those standards. Republicans also reportedly outspent Democrats in this race by a considerable margin, and it was to no avail. Unofficial final results in that race find the Democrat Bobby Bodeman with almost 52% of the vote, Dale Fincher behind Bodeman at about 48%, so about a 4-point margin there, but a 13-point overperformance from 2024 for the Democrats in this Republican district, and the that makes the third Democratic state legislative flip of this year alone, just in the first few months of 2026. And it is now the 10th special election flip from Republican to Democrat in Donald Trump's second term. Compared that to the number that Republicans have seen flipping Democratic seats to Republican, well, they have seen 0 compared to 10 for the Democrats.
Hmm.
Also, it is the 28th state legislative flip since the Trump regime came to power versus, I believe, yet again, 0 for the Republicans over that time. And here again, it was another 13-point overperformance for Democrats. That's been the average for the past year and change in these special elections.
It's been really consistent like that.
It's a consistent average in any event.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, it has been higher in some races. The primary in Georgia on Tuesday was a 17-point overperformance. But, yeah, a lot of times it is coming in right at 13, which Bilbo Teach says seems to be the baseline that anything Trump won that's plus 15 or less should be seen as potentially competitive this year. And that is a lot of seats in the U.S. House that were won by much smaller margin than 15 points. So, you know, y'all could be in trouble this year, Republicans, if you didn't win by, let's say, at least 10 or more. If you were 15 or more, you should be safe, but we will see. Because, you remember, 13 points was the average, not the maximum. I haven't seen any reports yet of major voting problems on Tuesday, though it sometimes takes a while for those to percolate to the light, as I always try to warn you. As is the case down in the great state of Texas, which held its statewide midterm primaries a few weeks ago at the beginning of the month, where this week Tarrant County, Texas poll workers told county commissioners about problems that they had with the county's computerized voting machines during the March primary election. Many reportedly said that hand-marked paper ballots are the solution to the problems they saw. Huh. There's an idea. They are, of course, correct about that. The 2026 primary election on March 3rd, according to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Desi, don't you guys call that the
Startlegram?
The Startlegram, yes. Down there, yeah. Anyway, according to the Startlegram, the election earlier in the month was Amy Woodward's 20th election serving as a judge at the polling place. Thank you, Amy, for that. But she said that her enthusiasm is now diminishing because of issues with the voting machines. Tarrant County, home to Fort Worth, forces all of the voters at the polls to vote on computerized ballot marking devices, or BMD voting systems, just like they do in Georgia. In this case, in Texas, in Tarrant County, they are systems made by the Texas-based Hart InterCivic Company. They are no better than the ones made by Dominion, used across the state of Georgia. But those are the systems where you use a touchscreen computer or one with a little dial on it, as in the Hart InterCivic machines, to sort of roll around the screen, make your selection. It prints out a piece of paper that maybe or maybe not represents what you tried to vote for on the screen. Then you scan that paper with another computer that tallies the ballots, either correctly or incorrectly. Who knows, unless a human actually counts it.
So instead of just marking it with your hand, you have to go through this whole
process of having
the computers
yes.
do all of it.
And as the Startlegram reports, between having to reboot machines and spoil ballots with machine-inflicted errors, because, you know, oh, the computer screwed up my vote. Please spoil my ballot. Let me do the whole process over again. With all of those problems earlier in the month, Woodward said that the modernized processes have caused undue stress on poll workers. So just to note, not voters complaining here about these systems, but poll workers who have traditionally been cited as a reason to use these computerized ballot marking device systems. Oh, they're easier for them somehow. In fact, it isn't, especially when they go wrong. And you've got to rely on 80-year-old, you know, hero poll workers like Thelma to come in and be the IT person to troubleshoot these machines somehow. Each of the poll workers complaining about the machines, according to the Star-Telegram at the county commissioner meeting this week, called for the county to switch to, yes, hand-marked paper ballots or even hand-counted ballots. At the Tuesday meeting, Republican County Judge Tim O'Hare asked Elections Administrator Clint Ludwig if the concerns raised by the poll workers indicated that more machine issues happened in the primary election than usual. Ludwig said that he could not decisively say that there were more issues because, in fact, primary elections require more machines in Texas than other elections. So there's a higher likelihood of problems. That because in Texas primary, voters are often forced to vote on different machines, one set for Republicans, another one for Democrats. Based on early data, Ludwig said there were, in fact, more spoiled ballots than usual, and his staff is looking into the reason as to why. Of course, one swell way to bring an election to its knees on election day, when it's running on computerized voting machines like this, is simply to claim that the computer mismarked your ballot, whether it did or not. There is no way to prove it either way. Something that we have been warning about for years with these dumb systems. These are just like the ones that are forced on voters at every single polling place across the entire battleground state of Georgia, for instance, as well as many counties across Texas, which, by the way, also has a key race for U.S. Senate this November. Want to screw up that election? Just go in there and say that the computer mismarked my vote, whether it did or not. This is a disaster waiting to happen, as I've been warning for, a couple of decades. All we can do is warn you about it. But, you know, keep up the dumb work, Texas. I'm sure it'll all go fine for you again this year. In the March 3rd election, the Republican ballot was said to have been 2 pages long. The Democratic ballot was 1 page long. Somehow that might have been the source of the issue. Nobody knows. Anyway, we will see. All right. All of that, elections still remain our first major step out of the mess created by, yes, our last major election. Yes, they are both the problem and the solution, as it turns out. Back from when Donald Trump was elected, for reasons that still define logic in my brain, at least. And, of course, all of the nightmares we had warned you about in that event before that election are, yes, now coming home to roost. We will catch you up on the latest in Trump's war in Iran. And we'll be joined for some common sense analysis of it all by our friend, professor, and author, David Ferris of Roosevelt University. That is next on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Another fine mess indeed. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. On February 18 this year, as Donald Trump weighed whether to launch military attacks on Iran, Chris Wright, his energy secretary and a former fossil fuel company CEO, told an interviewer at Bloomberg that he was not concerned that the looming war might disrupt oil supplies in the Middle East and wreak havoc in energy markets. Not worried about it at all. Even during the Israeli and U.S. strikes against Iran last June, Wright said, there had been little disruption in the markets after all. Quote, oil prices blipped up and then went back down, he said. According to the New York Times on Monday, some of Mr. Trump's other advisors shared similar views in private, dismissing warnings that the second time around, Iran might wage economic warfare by closing shipping lanes carrying roughly 20 to 30% of the world's oil and natural gas supply. The extent of that miscalculation now has seemingly been laid bare in recent days as Iran threatened to fire at commercial oil tankers transiting the Strait of Hormuz, the strategic choke point through which all ships must pass on their way in or out of the Persian Gulf. In response to the Iranian threats, commercial shipping has now come to a complete standstill in the Gulf. Oil prices have spiked, and the Trump administration has scrambled to find ways to tamp down an economic crisis that has triggered substantively higher gasoline prices for Americans. The episode, the Times argues, is emblematic of how much Mr. Trump and his advisors misjudged how Iran would respond to a conflict that the government in Tehran, for good reason, I would argue, though it seems like it should have been obvious to anyone, that the government in Iran sees as an existential threat at this time. Iran has responded far more aggressively than it did during last June's 12-day war, firing barrages of missiles and drones at U.S. military bases, cities in Arab nations across the Middle East, and on Israeli population centers, all of which seems like it should have been anticipated well in advance of launching such a war, though it doesn't seem like it was. Or if it was, those warnings were also dismissed by this administration. In turn, the Times reports U.S. officials have had to adjust their plans on the fly, from hastily ordering the evacuation of dozens of embassies, U.S. nationals from more than a dozen nations with no plan in place to help them get out of the region, to developing policy proposals to try and reduce oil and gas prices, all on the fly, all after the fact. After Trump administration officials gave a closed-door briefing to lawmakers on Tuesday, the paper reports, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, said on social media that the administration had no plan for the Strait of Hormuz and, quote, did not know how to get it safely back open. Inside the administration, some officials are said to be growing pessimistic about the lack of a clear strategy to finish the war, but they have been careful not to express that directly to the president, who has repeatedly declared that the military operation is a complete success, but one that will apparently nonetheless continue for the foreseeable future, or maybe not if he changes his mind tomorrow or over the next hour, or maybe never. Who really can know such things? So why exactly is he doing all of this? Well, no one seems to know that either. Even now, more than a week and a half into a war that has, as Time magazine described yesterday, brought about, quote, the single biggest disruption to oil in history. Trump has laid out maximalist goals like demanding, quote, unconditional surrender, which he demanded in the early hours of the attack, though he hasn't mentioned that demand of late. He has insisted that Iran name a leader of Trump's liking who will submit to him, though Iran has instead elevated the 56-year-old son of the previous 86-year-old Supreme Leader assassinated on the first day of the war in his place. Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, said the administration, quote, had a strong game plan before the war broke out and vowed that oil prices would drop after it ended, quote, the purposeful disruption in the oil market by the Iranian regime is short-term and necessary for the long-term gain of wiping out these terrorists and the threat they pose to America and the world, she said in a statement. The search for pathways out of the war, the Times reported, has gained urgency since the weekend as global oil prices surge and as the U.S. burns through costly munitions. While administration officials have suggested the war is costing about $1 billion a day, Pentagon officials reported that in a recent closed-door briefing on Capitol Hill that the military actually used up $5.6 billion of munitions in just the first 2 days of the war alone. That, according to three congressional officials, as reported by the Washington Post. And that is a far larger amount and munitions burn rate than the public had been told, though it's in sync with what historian and Middle Eastern expert Juan Cole argued on this program just about a week ago, just after the start of the war, when he suggested that the conflict was more likely to be a shorter one, given the lack of armaments actually available to U.S. and Israeli forces, and the fact that Iran was able to build hundreds of drones a day for about $30,000 each, while it cost the U.S. about $1.5 million per missile to intercept each one of those drones. In the bargain, Iranian officials have remained defiant. They say they will use their leverage over the world's oil supply to force the U.S. and Israel to blink. And of course, in an existential battle, why wouldn't they? Quote, Strait of Hormuz will either be a strait of peace and prosperity for all, said Ali Larijani, Iran's top national security official, in a social media post on Tuesday. Or, he said, quote, it will be a strait of defeat and suffering for warmongers. In the meantime, as Americans enter the critical midterm election season, which Republicans, if they are smart, might themselves soon begin seeing as an existential threat to them and to the Trump presidency, well, the war is not just already unpopular, but it is more unpopular than any major conflict in modern times that the U.S. has joined or begun. At the start of World War II, for example, in 1941, after the attack at Pearl Harbor, it's little surprise that 97% of Americans supported U.S. military intervention in the first days of that war. The 2001 attack against Afghanistan following 9/11 was nearly as popular in its early days, with 92% support among the public, according to polling averages compiled by the New York Times. The first Persian Gulf War under George Bush Sr. was supported by 82% of the American public, and the subsequent war in Iraq by his son George W. Bush, which would eventually become wildly unpopular, well, it enjoyed majority support by 76% of those polled at its beginning, when such conflicts are usually at their most popular. Donald Trump's Iran war, however, began with the support of just 41% of the American public. And it's difficult to see how it will become any more popular given the chaos, apparent lack of objective or plans that we have seen since its start, and the very real cost of the war already coming home to American pocketbooks as printed in great big reminders on great big signs in front of every gasoline station in the nation after only 1 year of a presidency that, in theory, began on the promise of bringing costs down for Americans and, yes, no more stupid foreign wars. All of that now seems to be falling apart as well, with no apparent plans from all the king's horses or all the king's men for how the hell to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Joining us now for more on all of this today is our old friend David Ferris, associate professor of political science at Roosevelt University in Chicago. He is also now a contributor at The Nation. He has a background in Middle Eastern studies and scholarship, having written or contributed to books on both Egypt and Iran, as well as several more recent books on domestic politics, including his latest, The Kids Are All Left, How Young Voters Will Unite America. I wish they'd hurry. Professor Ferris, it has been too long, sir. Welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Great to be back, Brad. Thanks so much for having me on.
So this is a mess, it seems to me. We'll get into some of the specifics in a moment, but am I missing anything here? Are we in another war of choice in the Middle East with no clear reason to be there at all, no clear way to get out under a president who ran for years, at least pretending to be against stupid foreign interventionism and endless wars in the Middle East? I mean, I'm no expert or academic on the subject matter like yourself, David, but it just seems to me as simple as that. Am I missing anything here?
No, not really. I mean, this is it's giving me terrible flashbacks to the early 2000s, right? When we all remember this country stumbling into a series of endless conflicts that people, you know, experts warned policymakers, like, this is a bad idea, don't do this.
Right.
And then we did the thing, and then we paid for it, right? I remember at one point calculating that the total costs of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, which has been estimated to be as high as $6 trillion, will exceed the total value of all of the oil that was imported into the United States between 1980 and 2012.
Wow.
Right. So just on a basic strategic level, right, this kind of policymaking in the Persian Gulf has failed us before, it is failing us now, and it will continue to fail in the future because it is a failed policy, right? And one that we thought, or I think a lot of people thought, that Donald Trump was not in favor of, right? But it turns out he just didn't like how those wars were waged.
And right? I don't even know if that was true. I mean, you know, he used to pretend that he was against the war in Iraq when we have him on tape saying, well, I guess it's fine, you know, I guess I'm in favor of it. So it's not like, you know, he was some champion, some I told you so champion. I think he joined a lot of people when the war in, Iraq turned badly of saying, I was against this from the beginning. So, I mean, that sort of seems like a myth to me from the jump, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, he's such an impressionable person, right? He's like very rumored to be just like very swayable by the last person that he talks to. And I also think that his views on things shift very, very dramatically and very quickly based on new information or like his perception of that new information, right? So I think how you could characterize Trump's relationship to war is that he's perfectly fine with war as long as they can be won quickly in a way that allows him to go out and proclaim victory and not to have any sort of like long-term cost for the United States, right? And I think that that is a pattern that led them to stumble into this particular conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Not understanding, but when they assassinated the supreme leader of Iran in this bombing, they turned it into a very different conflict, mm-hmm. than the one that he's been prosecuting since his first term, right? I remember he killed the leader of the IRGC in 2020.
Right.
They bombed the Iranian nuclear sites last summer. But because these were limited conflicts, Iran didn't push its kind of like nuclear button, right? Mm-hmm. I don't mean like a nuclear weapon. I mean, like they have, you know, they have one thing in their arsenal that is a real strategic disincentive for the United States to undertake this kind of action. And Trump crossed that red line. Not just did he kill the Supreme Leader, he killed the whole layer of leadership under the Supreme Leader. And now this has become an existential conflict for Iran. And because it's an existential conflict, they are doing everything that they can to prevent shipping from getting through the Strait of Hormuz, which mm-hmm. is like, you know, unbelievable that people in the Trump administration did not know right. or did not believe that this could happen. It's like astonishing, right? But there's reasons for that too, right?
Well, it's kind of mind-blowing, and particularly since they don't really even need to be able to do it. In other words, just the threat. You know, I don't know about you, but I don't want to get on one of those shipping, you know, those oil barges. With no protection at all, and go through the Strait of Hormuz on the promise that, the U.S. is guaranteeing, you know, the insurance company. Good Lord, who would do that? I mean, it's such an easy response that they overlooked here. Now, if as I noted at the top of the intro there, David, Trump's Energy Secretary Chris Wright, he argued at the start of the war that, you know, disruption of world oil supplies are nothing to worry about. Well, the Energy Department is actually focused more on nuclear energy than oil and gas. I don't know if, you know, Trump knows that or not, but if Chris Wright was so wrong about perfectly predictable issues concerning, you know, oil and gas, do we have any reason to believe that the administration is any better prepared for potential nuclear consequences? And I don't, you know, I mean real nuclear consequences that could be related here if, you know, if a civil war, as Trump actually, you know, seemed to be fomenting in Iran, if that actually came about. This was mentioned sort of in passing here by Fareed Zakaria on CNN on Monday. Let me get your thoughts on it on the other side.
The idea of an Iran that collapses into civil war with Shia militias running around.
With nuclear material.
With nuclear material, exactly. Dirty bombs that could be made. You know, it's bad for Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf allies of the United States who want free flow of oil. You know, if you wage an existential war against a nation, they're going to pull out all the stops. Their response is also going to be existential. They want to inflict harm on you.
So, David, if they didn't sort out, think through the just, you know, the simple mechanics of oil and gas in, you know, coming out of the Persian Gulf, how easy it is to stop that at the Strait of Hormuz. Do you have any confidence that they've actually thought through any further regarding things like nuclear material in the region? Should they actually get that civil war that Donald Trump seemed to be fomenting for so long?
No, of course not. I mean, I don't have any confidence in the policymaking of this administration at all. I mean, one of the big reasons for that is that they've gutted the State Department, right? They're very clearly not relying on people with any kind of regional expertise at all, right? Like Jared Kushner is running Middle East policy for the United States of yeah. America right now, right? The kind of people who could have produced something like the State Department's Future of Iraq report, right? If you remember this back from the early 2000s, we put together a very lavishly funded report about like all the different ways that we could look at the fallout of a potential invasion of Iraq, right? And that document actually warned us pretty clearly about some of the things that would happen, and George W. Bush set it aside anyway. But we're not even doing that, right? Like we're not even producing intelligence that we then set aside. We're not even producing right. expertise that we set aside. We just don't have the expertise, full stop.
Right.
Right. Like the State Department mm-hmm. has been hollowed out. He obviously doesn't rely on the National Security Council at all. He's relying on a handful of sycophants like within his administration, as well as I think the Israeli prime minister, who obviously has some kind of back channel to him. He's relying on people without any expertise in the region. Right. He's being led by the nose, I think, by people that have wanted to do this for a long time and who I think very arrogantly thought that killing the Supreme Leader would set off a chain of events that would either lead to regime collapse or the transfer of authority within the regime to somebody more friendly to the Trump administration, like happened in Venezuela. And the fact that they thought that in the first place is in itself evidence that they are not being advised by anyone with any kind of meaningful expertise about this region or Iran in particular, right? And that's really scary to me because we're all on this plane, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, Trump does not. I mean, they do away with that because I think Trump doesn't think he needs it. He thinks he knows everything that needs to be known and that he's smarter or, you know, as smart or smarter than anyone, it seems. But, you know, while this is obviously a mess, oil prices going up, chaos, blah, 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 no clear way out. There are some very serious issues here. You wrote last year at Newsweek after the initial strike against Iran by the U.S. and Israel, against at the time its nuclear facilities last June, even while the Trump administration was supposedly negotiating with Iran for a new nuclear treaty, which I think they were doing now as well. But you wrote that the U.S. attack ended up reversing decades of nuclear diplomacy and that other nations around the world, friend and foe alike, would now be, quote, likely to conclude that they will be safer and more secure in the long run by joining the nuclear club. Isn't it safe to say that the U.S., David Ferris, would likely not have attacked Iran if, in fact, they did have a nuclear weapon? I mean, has any nation with nuclear weapons ever been attacked by a superpower?
No. Right. Like nuclear weapons are in a lot of ways functionally useless on the battlefield. Right. It's one of the many reasons they haven't been used in the last 80 years. And one of the reasons that we remain the only country that's ever used them in combat. But what they do is they confer upon the countries that have them a sort of like you're invasion proof. Right. That tiny little chance that the nuclear armed country might use a nuclear weapon against you is a strong enough disincentive to discourage this kind of adventurism. It is, in fact, why the Iranians wanted nuclear weapons in the first place.
Wow.
And everything that has happened over the past 20 years, from, you know, like Libya, for example, agreed to give up its nuclear weapons program, and then we overthrew the government, right? Ukraine in the
90s,
yeah. Right? They voluntarily gave up the nuclear weapons that they found themselves in possession of when the Soviet Union collapsed, signed an agreement with Russia guaranteeing their sovereignty, and like, look where that's gotten them, right? Yep. So there's this like lesson after lesson after lesson that says to countries that are worried about their security or worried about the United States bombing or invading them or overthrowing the regime, that the only way to prevent that from happening for sure is to get a nuclear weapon, right?
Yep.
And that's why people that work on nuclear weapons policy are really worried that one of the long range effects of what's happening right now is what we call a proliferation cascade, right? That's like a bunch of countries simultaneously pursuing weapons, either in response to this or response to each other. And then we end up with a world, instead of 10 nuclear powers, we have 20.
Yep.
Right. And that's just a less safe world. That's kind of a catastrophe, a policymaking catastrophe that I think we're headed towards inexorably if we don't see a reversal here pretty soon.
Right. And I think we're not looking at that as much. I mean, we're looking at the, sort of the immediate consequences. We're looking at the domestic costs of this. And I do want to move it from that, from the foreign realm back to the domestic. The White House and the right-wing media outlets have been rolling out this talking point over the past day or two or three that the Iran war is going to require us to endure some, quote, short-term pain for long-term gain. They've been repeating this all over and over, saying it in unison, all of the, you know, the White House, all of their apparatchik, all of the, you know, right-wing media outlets. Here's Kansas Republican U.S. Senator Roger Marshall suggesting that Americans must be willing to sacrifice for long-term gain.
Again, freedom is not free. Americans are going to have to make some sacrifices, but we're operating from a point of strength. Isn't it great that compared to when I was growing up in the 70s, we were so dependent upon Middle East oil, but now we're the largest producer of oil in the world, that we're the second biggest exporter of oil in the world. So we're not going to be shut out economically from this. We at least have the oil here. Yes, it's a worldwide commodity, but this is one of the prices of war. Are we willing to stand here for 47 years and let Iran beat the heck out of Americans and kill thousands of Americans? Or are we willing to stand up and say enough of this?
Yeah, isn't it great, David? We've got all the oil that we could ever use now, so what are we so worried about? Are we willing to make those short-term sacrifices, David, as you see it? And if so, for what? What is the long-term gain? That even that much seems unclear to me.
Well, it's unclear because they don't know, right? Like, there's no way to communicate the stakes of something to the American people if you yourself don't have a strategic goal in mind, don't have a sense of what the fallout or the consequences might be. You're obviously not going to be able to prepare the American people to make sacrifices for that thing, right? And I think that the American people rightly perceived that there was no imminent threat to American national security from Iran. And thus this whole episode feels like it came out of nowhere for people, right? Like, right. It's not just that, like, you know, the people mistakenly perceived Trump as some kind of dove or anti-war. That's obviously not true. I think that's been proven conclusively untrue over the past year. But there was no effort in the ramp up to this conflict to do any kind of public relations campaign. That's why it's one of the reasons you go to Congress to get an authorization for the use of force. Is to get the American people on board. You got to get Congress on board. You got to get the American people on board. Mm-hmm. You have to give them a rationale, right? Like, if people don't understand why you're fighting, then every setback and every sacrifice that you're making is going to feel pointless. And you know who to blame, right? Like, Trump started this war, right? If you don't like the one of the consequences of the Iran war, there's only one place to point the finger, right? And that's at Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's what's going to happen. And it's going to get worse the longer this goes on, because the Republicans were already in a pretty bad place heading into this midterm election, right? They simply cannot afford for the national economic environment to deteriorate in such a way that it, like, kind of it removes the floor of Republican support at a certain point. If things go badly enough, right? Like, you could see people losing races that they otherwise would not lose. It takes possible gains or pickups for Republicans just off the table altogether. And there was already some of that stuff going on, right? But you start a war with uncertain economic consequences. You make everything more expensive. The price of gas goes up. You know, the supply chain interruptions start happening, right? Like, pandemic era supply chain interruptions. That could be a catastrophe for them come November, and they're already in a pretty bad position.
Well, you heard Roger Marshall. Well, Time Magazine, you heard asserting that this is the single biggest disruption to oil in history. I guess that remains to be seen if that's really the case, but why does any of that actually matter if we've got so much of our own supply, as you heard Senator Marshall there bragging about, as you've heard Donald Trump saying, you know, oh, now thanks to him, we're completely energy independent. Of course, that happened under Barack Obama, but never mind that. If we are energy independent now, why does any of this matter? Isn't this the whole reason why we became independently, you know, energy independent, that we don't have to worry about the Middle East anymore? Again, what am I missing there?
Yeah, bro, I don't know where to start. Look, I mean, the thing is that, like, Roger Marshall, to the extent that he understands this, just simply does not understand how global oil markets work and the relationship of a global oil market to the price of gasoline in the United States, right? There's been an oil production revolution in the U.S., right? Like, we figured out how to extract oil from shale sands, and that has made us a net oil exporter. But the way it does not work, we don't own the oil, right? Like, we don't have a national oil company in the United States, right? And that means that all of the oil that we are bringing to market just goes on the market, right? Like, the pipeline that, you know, that takes the oil to the Gulf of Mexico and then goes on, that's owned by oil companies. Mm-hmm. And so an increase in our oil output it lowers the aggregate price of oil, right? But it's not like we just have our own supply that we can use ourselves and then we're fine.
We would actually have to nationalize the oil companies, the thing that we've gone to war against, not just Venezuela recently, but actually that kicked off all of this, all of these follies in Iran in the first place, way back in the 1940s and 50s.
Right, exactly. And I think the Republican Party has fundamentally misunderstood what energy independence means for the whole century. Right? The only way to really extricate ourselves from our economic reliance on oil and other fossil fuels is to pursue the green revolution. Right? Like, the more people you get driving electric cars, the more people you get getting off of fossil fuels and you know, wind and solar, all these renewables. But, like, that's what energy independence is, right? It's not dramatically increasing your own oil production unless you're willing to nationalize it and just, like, have a, you know, it's like we get all our oil from ourselves.
Yeah.
Which, you know, can't really just snap your finger and do that.
Yeah.
The Republican Party itself has been undermining the very sort of historical transition that would actually make gas prices less important politically in the United States. And so partly as a consequence of their own intransigence about climate change, about the Green Revolution, this is where we are, right? Where we are is gas prices still matter politically in the United States of America because almost everyone still drives a gas-powered car. And oil and petroleum, like, these are inputs into all kinds of other industries that I think most people don't really have like a very dim awareness of the fact that like oil and petroleum products go into all kinds of like fertilizers. I mean, you name it, right?
Yep.
Plastics, right? Like oil is so deeply embedded in the global economy. No amount of like shale oil in North Dakota is going to extract us from that basic predicament until we do the things that Democrats have been talking about for a long time, which is transition our entire economy gradually to less reliance on fossil fuels. And, right?
Yeah, and we have been doing just the opposite under Donald Trump. Let me give you two very big questions for which I have very little time, David. First, why in the end, if we've gone through, you know, all of these reasons, oh, it's not regime change, it's not for the oil, it's not for, you know, there was no imminent threat, we had already obliterated their nuclear facilities, as we were told over and over again. Why in the end do you think, therefore, that we did this, David? Why is all this even happening as you see it?
Right. I think, you know, in the end, to the extent that Donald Trump has consistent thoughts in his addled and declining brain, I think that he sees overthrowing the Iranian regime as possibly like something that could be his signature foreign policy achievement, right? Going back to his first term, when he unilaterally withdrew the United States from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran deal, mm-hmm. right? He set us off on this collision course with Iran, right? Like he pulled us out of the nuclear deal, right? Like Democrats and Republicans throughout the century have declared again and again, like, we can't have a nuclear Iran, right? And Iran was moving slowly, I think, but moving towards a nuclear weapon. I don't think they were anywhere near it. but we've kind of walked into our own trap, right? And Trump himself, I think, believed and had been talked into believing that a series of airstrikes could quickly decapitate the Iranian regime, right, and have Khamenei replaced by someone. I don't think he really cares whether it's another authoritarian. In fact, I know he doesn't care. This isn't about democracy,
right?
Okay, he wanted power transferred to someone like we did in Venezuela, who would cut a deal with us, right? Like he wanted to be able to go out and be like, look, I got what we've been seeking forever, right? We've deposed this horrible government. It's now in the hands of this random authoritarian, and this random authoritarian is willing to sign a deal that in which Iran gives up all of its enrichment capacity, right? That's been a demand of that's been a very unrealistic demand of the Trump administration this whole time, and it has led us to this worst case scenario. Okay, we've expended all of this treasure. We've killed a lot of people. We have killed the supreme leader, and instead of getting that either quick and easy regime change or regime collapse, all we have succeeded in doing so far is transferring authority to Khamenei's kid,
right,
who by
exactly.
all accounts is more extreme than he was.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's why he did it. Right. I think he thought like, I'll decapitate the regime. I'll be a hero. And maybe that could turn around our fortunes in the midterms. Right.
Exactly. Bring it back to that. I think it turns around our fortunes in the midterms. And I think all of the things that you say are absolutely true. And if yet far too high-minded. I mean, ultimately, I think it was because there's a woman in the Epstein files who, you know, alleges that he raped a 13-year-old and that going to war in the Middle East, going against Iran at this point was just about the only thing that was going to get that off the front pages. And by the way, it did. So all of those other things seem to me that you suggest seem to me to be absolutely true, but maybe avoid the real reason. I don't know.
Right. I mean, and these things all can be true.
Yep.
Right. I mean, I do think that he was convinced by someone that this would be easy. Obviously, it has succeeded in getting some of the worst Epstein news off of the front pages for the time being.
Yep.
Worth noting, that's another issue where he set his own trap and then walked into it, right? Like,
yes.
By making the Epstein trials a major issue in the 2024 campaign. I don't know what he thought was going to happen there, right? But the only reason that that issue has high salience to begin with is because they did it.
Yes, exactly.
And so he's got two issues that are both really bad for him. He's walked into both of these traps, right? And I don't know that he see, like, I don't know what their conception of a way out is, right? But if they don't wrap up this war like very quickly, you're going to see their political position deteriorate in a way that's going to set off a lot of alarm bells at Republican headquarters.
Yeah, domestically, yeah, and in Iran itself. If he declares victory and walks away, I've only got 30 seconds here. But how does Iran respond? Do we end up seeing now again decades of either civil war or attempts at retribution against the U.S.?
Well, I think if he walks away right now, what we have is just like we have what we had in Iraq in the 90s, right? We have just like a persistent low level conflict with a weak but intransigent regime that we cannot depose from the air. And that, you know, that's probably better than the war for Trump, right? But it's certainly not any kind of policy outcome that we could declare a success.
David Farris is associate professor of political science at Roosevelt University in the Windy City. His latest book is The Kids Are All Left, How Young Voters Will Unite America. And not a moment too soon. You can find him on the Blue Skies at David Farris, and you can read his work at thenation.com. David, great speaking with you, my friend. Let's do it again soon.
I'd love to come back anytime, Brad. Hopefully we won't be at war next time.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be fine. Thanks, man.
All right, take care.
All right, when have we not been at war, by the way? Isn't there always a war, some war ongoing
somewhere
these days?
That the United States is involved in? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it is just, we're back at it again in the Middle East.
It'll all work out. Don't you worry. Don't you worry, your pretty little self. You know, he's just going to turn around and say, it's over, we won, and bring everybody home, and then pretend that he didn't leave a mess behind, and nobody look at that civil war, nobody look at that power vacuum that, you know, created ISIS last time and all of that stuff.
Yeah, he'll say it has nothing to do with him.
It'll be fine. Yeah, not his fault. Okay, that's it. Let's get the hell out. My thanks again to David. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. My thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always an honor. It's always appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show, want to give it another listen? Want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate? You can do it for free at bradblog.com. Download it anytime. No paywall there. That is thanks to those of you who hit one of those donate buttons. It really only takes about 30, 60 seconds to fill out a form and help us out, help us continue to do what we try to do every day over your public airwaves. We rely only on you for that help. You can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me an email if you like. Always good to hear from you. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, I am the Brad Blog. We will see it all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.